Wing TV, with Victor Thorne and Lisa Giuliani. The revolution is being televised.
Hello, it's Monday, November 1st, and you're watching Wing TV. I'm Lisa Giuliani.
And I'm Victor Thorne. Welcome to Wing TV. Hope everybody had a good weekend. Mm-hmm. We caught up on a few things here. And today, we have Mr. Dylan Avery, who's in the process of making a film about 9/11 called Loose Change. But before we bring him on, we want to remind everyone that Wing Magazine number 8 is now online. This is the longest issue we've ever had. If you go into the Wing TV homepage, and if you look up near the top, you'll see a link that says Wing Magazine number 8. Also, if I'm not mistaken, I think there's some kind of election tomorrow, isn't there?
I think so.
I think there is. So, we want everyone to go out there and vote. And we got an email from someone today that says, well, you know, it's just because you guys don't vote, and we never once gave the impression on the show that we don't vote. In fact, I've voted in every single election since I was able to when I was 18 years old. So definitely go out and read the articles on the Wing TV homepage. I wrote one called Anybody But Bush or Kerry. And also there's a guy named Bill Shaw who wrote another article in the same vein. So please read those and just, you know, let yourself know what Bush and Kerry are all about.
Make sure you stand up and be counted. If you don't like what's going on, you don't like the deception, let your vote be a vote of dissent.
Right. Also, one last thing. Tomorrow, we're going to film at 9 o'clock in the morning a.m. So if anybody wants to call in and voice their opinions, we're not going to have any guests on tomorrow. So what's the number, Lisa?
272-0313, area code 814.
Right. And you can find that on the
on our Wing website when you go to watch the movie.
Yeah, you'll see it there. So if you want to voice your opinion, give us a call. It's 9 o'clock a.m. Eastern Standard Time. So with those announcements out of the way, we'd like to introduce Mr. Dylan Avery to Wing TV. How you doing, Dylan?
Welcome, Dylan.
Pretty good, guys.
Well, we had a chance to see your movie last night, and this is still the raw footage or the raw cut of it, but I tell you, it's some very powerful stuff. So you're well on your way to making a very impressive movie.
Well, thanks, guys. It means a lot to me.
Yeah.
Well, when will it be available for the public, Dylan?
In like a week or two.
Very good. And we're going to make this available on Wing TV also when it is in its final form. So to get started, Dylan, after we watched the different segments of your movie, we picked out some things that maybe haven't been talked about quite as much as other areas of 9/11. And I remember speaking with a woman about a year ago about the World Trade Center towers and how these fires couldn't have made them collapse. And she uses an argument that many others have used, that there's this fireball that raged through the elevator shafts and spread through the buildings, and that's how it melted everything and brought the World Trade Center towers to its knees. So tell everyone how this is a fallacy and a ruse.
I'm really not a science expert, but I think from a mere common sense point of view, I think heat rises. And I think if there was a raging fireball, it would have gone up and melted the top 30 floors as opposed to the bottom 70.
Right.
And then, like, you see all the damage in the lobby of the North Tower, and everyone's like, oh, yeah, it was a raging fireball that went barreling down the elevator shafts. But if you look at the lobby, there's no soot, there's no fire damage, there's no nothing. It looks more like, you know, high-energy explosives were set off.
Yeah. And you included in your documentary a lot of footage, mainstream footage of reporters, firemen, and, in fact, people like Peter Jennings talking about how, what did he say here? He said that it was up. If you want to get to bring a building down, you have to attack the under-infrastructure to bring
exactly.
the building down. I mean, Peter Jennings was saying this.
Yeah.
Yep.
And Pat Dawson, talk about his accounts. The reporter.
Pat Dawson. Which one was he again?
He was the one who was talking about another bomb going off. He was, reporting live action.
He talked to the chief of safety for the New York City Fire Department, and the chief told him that, like, this is the chief of the Fire Department of New York, and he said that there were bombs planted in the building. Not only that, but they're continuing to hear explosions going off downtown.
Right.
And, I mean, this is, you know, this is in the same vein of a lot of stuff that was broadcast once that day, and then you never saw it again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, you really got to dig deep. There's a lot of similarities between the World Trade Center bombing and Oklahoma City bombing. But there's a lot of news reports of people saying, you know, we've got extra bombs found inside the building. You know, a lot of that stuff you're not going to be able to see anymore.
An eyewitness two blocks away from the World Trade Center on 9/11 reported six brief light flashes between floors 10 and 15. Would you like to talk about that a little bit?
yeah, that's basically the extent of the quote. There was an eyewitness about on Church Street actually, which is like one or two blocks away from the World Trade Center. He saw a bunch of lights going off between floors 10 and 15 in the South Tower right before it collapsed. Not only that, he said he heard a brief crackling sound accompanying those flashes. So those might have been the start of the Cutter charges.
Yeah.
But now, basically, I'm sorry, what were you saying?
Oh, well, during my visits to New York City, I've been to New York probably about a dozen times, and I've been to the World Trade Center Tower almost every one of those times because we used to go visit a Borders bookstore, which was right on the ground floor. And unless someone's been inside these buildings, these towers, they don't realize how huge they are. And in your movie, you say that there was 200,000 tons of steel. There was 425,000 cubic feet of concrete. There were even 103 elevators. Now, how can anyone believe that 10,000 gallons of jet fuel brought these enormous structures to their knees, especially when you show these buildings being built and how strong they were?
Exactly. I mean, when these buildings were being built, they were intended to be the tallest structures in the world. And I think when you're sitting down, when Kiyosaki and Lee Robertson were sitting down planning these buildings, they weren't just like, all right, well, let's just build them. You know, they had to take into consideration every single thing that could have gone wrong.
Uh-huh.
There's actually one segment that I'm still not sure if I'm going to put in, but it talks about all the people who built the towers, and like Van Romero, for example, who said, I think bombs brought down those buildings. A lot of the people that designed these buildings, they designed them for, earthquakes, hurricanes, a 150-year storm is actually another one of the figures that I heard, and not only that, a 707 hitting it.
Right. And most of this fuel burned up within the first minute or two.
Yeah. And then you got that quote from Chief Palmer, who was actually on the 78th floor.
Right.
And he said that there were two small pockets of fire. And, I mean, if there was a 2,000, I mean, that's another thing about the official story that's just ludicrous. It says that there was a 2,000-degree inferno. But, I mean, jet fuel, and this is in a pure oxygen environment, jet fuel will burn at a maximum of 1,850 degrees Fahrenheit. And not only that, industrial steel will start to melt at, I think, 2,250, something like that.
Yeah, I think it's actually 2,795.
That makes it even more ludicrous.
If you ask the question, how could a fuel-sourced explosion cause such instant multi-directional destruction of these buildings? And despite the reporters and the firemen and numerous accounts of secondary and other explosions going off, the official version just doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Absolutely not. I mean, after you've watched these videos so many times and you start to analyze them like I have, I mean, all you have to do is just watch it. And it's completely common sense. I mean, there's no way that jet fuel did damage. I mean, that building was pulverized. I mean, it seriously just disintegrated from the top down.
Yeah.
I mean, it's ridiculous to think that jet fuel could have caused that much energy.
Yeah. And we're going to get into, the possibility that some explosives or charges were planted in this building. But first of all, you give in your movie some live radio transmissions from the firemen, specifically the chief of safety for the FDNY, and he was describing these secondary devices, these bombs going off that he said were placed inside the building. So you have numerous firemen, before they've been censored or gag ordered, saying that there was bombs in the building.
Exactly. I think you have to take the firefighters' word for it. I mean, if anything, I mean, first you got eyewitnesses and then you got reporters, but, I mean, firefighters, they're in buildings constantly. And, I think they know the difference between, let's say, a substation blowing up, which is what some people said these explosions were, and an actual bomb going off. And numerous firefighters all said, there were bombs in the building.
Okay, can 12 tons of titanium be vaporized by jet fuel, Dylan?
Absolutely not.
Yeah. Now, we've mentioned before the possibility of bombs in the building, and you bring up a guy named Ben Fountain, who is a financial analyst, and he said that there were unannounced and unusual evacuation drills weeks prior to 9/11 in both the World Trade Center buildings and WTC-7. You also mentioned Scott Forbes, who I interviewed for this book here, 9/11 Exposed, and devote an entire chapter to him. And he said basically the same thing, that there were, power downs and evacuations and so forth. Do you think that's when the explosive or the charges were planted inside the towers?
Well, there's one of two theories that I'm currently kicking around, and a lot of people can't seem to agree with it. Either the buildings were wired or at least built to be demolished, like they were wired when they were built to be destroyed. There's actually one thing that me and Phil are talking about, where the core of the World Trade Center was actually coated with C4 rebar. Like, every single floor of the core was coated with C4. And, you know, there's either that theory or the theory, you know, even the unusual drills in the weeks beforehand, I think, at the very least, they were safeguarding it, making sure that they were going to go up.
Right.
Checking all the wiring, make sure everything was in sync. I talked to Scott Forbes on the phone, and actually I wanted to interview him for my movie, but I wanted to actually get it on film. But he basically corroborated everything. He also added something interesting, that the second after the South Tower was hit, not the exact second, but basically right after the South Tower was hit, the entire lobby was destroyed.
Yeah. What I'll do is I'll put a, I don't think I send you a copy of this, but I'll send you a copy of 9/11 Exposed and let you read his article.
The South Tower registered as a 2.1 earthquake on seismometers, and the North Tower a 2.3 earthquake. What else have you found out about those spikes?
About the spikes? Well, they're two very, very sharp, very, very sudden spikes. And not only that, they are, you know, they're very sharp and they start to recede. You know, they don't gradually rise up. I mean, it's one short cutter. It's like one short explosion going off, and then it tapers down in about, you know, maybe a second or two.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of the people that study those seismographs, they said, you know, that's basically the kind of stuff they registered when they test atomic bomb sensors. They see a very short, very large spike, and then it tapers off very quickly.
Interesting. Now, when we have to look at the Bush family. And there's been a lot of discussion about Jeb Bush. Well, more about George W. Bush himself. And we've all seen Fahrenheit 9/11, where he's sitting in there reading the kid's book about the goat. And fewer people know that Jeb Bush, his brother, who's the governor of Florida, declared martial law 2 or 3 days prior.
On the 7th.
Right,
yeah,
4 days to 9/11. But the person who's almost not spoken about at all is Marvin Bush. So tell us about his role in 9/11.
Marvin Bush was one of the principals at a company called Securicom, which actually, if you look up Securicom now, it doesn't exist. They turned into a company called Stratasec. Securicom provided the security for Dulles International Airport. It was either American or United Airlines, I can't remember. And from the early 1990s up to 9/11, the World Trade Center. Like, Marvin Bush was running security at the World Trade Center. And for a lot of, I mean, that should send up a red flag right away.
So you have all three brothers, either directly or indirectly, involved in 9/11.
Exactly. In fact, the one person we don't hear anything about is Daddy Bush.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was actually at a Carlisle meeting that morning. So there you got four, because the Carlisle group has made tons of money off of this war in Iraq.
He was at Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska, right?
Well, that's where they took George W. later in the day, was to Offutt Air Force Base.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Yeah, actually, you're right about that.
The afternoon of 9/11, you've noticed that President Bush was supposed to actually be visiting the Pentagon. What have you found out about that?
I haven't found out much about that, except that I've seen it mentioned a number of times.
Uh-huh.
The other thing is that, you know, this is something small, and it may not even mean anything, but, you know, President Bush gave his speech at the school 9:30.
Uh-huh.
You know, declaring 9/11. He also was actually scheduled to give a speech at 9:30 exactly. You know, just giving a speech where, oh yeah, this is my No Child Left Behind plan.
Uh-huh.
So they either whipped up a speech for 9/11 really, really quickly, or, you know, like I said, it's one of those really small inconsistencies that could mean one thing or the other.
And isn't it amazing that he was right on schedule to give this speech at the exact place where it was publicly announced where he was going to be? Here we are, supposedly under attack from terrorism, from terrorists, and he's in the same exact place that was publicly broadcast where he would be giving a speech with all those kids there. I mean, it just doesn't add up. It's such a fallacy that it seemed to be no panic whatsoever. It's just like, well, we're here. Everybody knows we're here. We'll just give the speech right on the spot.
there's actually two things about that. One, I don't know if you've read about the group of Middle Eastern men that pulled up around 5 or 6 in the morning.
Uh-huh.
And they were talking to an agent of the Secret Service, and they said they had an interview with President Bush, and they got turned away because they didn't have an appointment. There's that, and the other thing is, like, if I was the Secret Service and our nation was under attack and President Bush was, you know, in Sarasota, Florida, where everybody knows he is, the first thing I would do is I would get him the hell out of there.
Right. Oh, yeah. Without a doubt.
Describe some of the inconsistencies between the FBI website's description of Osama bin Laden and what he's seen doing in other videos where his handwriting and all that. I know you've talked about that.
Yeah, and the Bin Laden confession tape, you know, this fat Jamaican actor that they slapped a beard on and called Osama Bin Laden, he's writing a note with his right hand. But if you go to the FBI's website, they describe him as left-handed.
Yeah.
And not only that, this, you know, phony Osama is wearing a gold ring and a gold watch. And like I told you guys, that segment, you know, it's kind of, I didn't get to mention all that, but he's wearing both a gold ring and a gold watch on his right hand. And if you look at the Quran, it's very explicitly noted that men are not allowed to wear gold whatsoever.
Right.
Yeah. And boy, they just keep hauling old Osama out, too, whenever it's convenient. Now,
yeah, I mean, we're not even going to mention that tape that just got released a few days ago.
Exactly.
Who knows what's up with that?
Yeah. Now, another thing you included in your movie was a Fox reporter that was on the scene in New York City on the morning of 9/11 named Mark Birnbach. And he said, and he reported this live on the air. He said that when he saw the second, or was it the second or first plane? I'm not sure. Hit the World Trade Center towers. He said this didn't look like a normal commercial airline. Those are his exact words. So tell us a little bit about, you know, how these tapes have never seen the light of day again except for when they were originally broadcast.
I think there's a very good reason for that. You know, there's actually a lot of eyewitnesses in New York. I read a report. I can't remember which website it was, but last night this guy went to New York City in the vicinity of Ground Zero, and he asked certain people, he's like, you know, what you see? He's like, well, you know, first of all, the second plane, to me it didn't look like a United Airlines jet, which, you know, has a very distinct silver and blue paint scheme.
Mm-hmm.
He said what he saw was a silver cargo jet.
Uh-huh.
And actually, in all the videos you see, I mean, the plane is very, to me it appears silver. And unfortunately, we really don't have a clear enough shot of the second plane to distinguish whether or not it has any markings. There's actually one photo I've seen where you can see something on one of the tail fins that actually looks like the UA, but there's no, you know, crystal clear definitive shots of the second plane. So I think if we can get our hands on that, then I think that can sell it once and for all.
The Pentagon. Flight 77 had 58 passengers. Over half of those passengers were affiliated or worked for government agencies, and the pilot was a Navy Top Gun. Talk about the Pentagon a little bit, some of the inconsistencies with the official story.
Where do you want me to start? The
Pentagon. Anywhere you want.
Well, a lot of the government agencies that you mentioned were directly involved in military. There were a number of employees from Raytheon, which is the developer of the Global Hawk. There were members of Boeing. There was actually three members of Boeing on that plane. EMS Solutions, which I think is the company that develops ballistic and cruise missiles. It seems like, you know, there's a lot of different theories about this, but either these people were a part of 9/11 and, you know, they told them, like, oh, yeah, get on this plane, we're going to take you to a conference, and, you know, that was the end of that. Or they were already in the wing of the Pentagon, you know, because the Navy wing is the one that got hit. So they were either already in that wing and they just made them passengers. But, I mean, there's really no way to absolutely tell. The other thing I didn't get to mention in the movie, which I'm going to, is a little kid by the name of Bernard Brown Jr.
Mm-hmm.
You guys heard about him?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bernard Brown Jr. is a 8 or 9 year old boy who, on the morning of 9/11, was going on a National Geographic field trip with his class. And on that morning, his father, Bernard Brown Sr., who works in the Navy wing of the Pentagon, sat his son down and had a talk with him about death, because his son was scared about flying on the plane or whatever. And Bernard Sr. was like, hey, you know, don't be afraid to die, because everybody's going to someday. And his son got on Flight 77. We know what happened to that. Well, actually, we don't know what happened to Flight 77, but we know what happened to Bernard. And Bernard Brown Sr., according to his wife, took an unusual day off from work to go play golf. Like, this is a man that never took a single day off from work. And after telling his son not to be afraid to die, he takes a day off from work to go play golf. And had he not been on the golf course, he would have been killed.
Huh. Very interesting.
I know.
Yeah.
Has anyone talked to that guy?
What's that?
Has anybody tried to question him?
Me and Phil were actually considering tracking him down and getting him on the phone just to, you know, talk to him about 9/11, see if anything slips, but I think he was either deeply involved with it and, you know, talking to him on the phone about it might not be such a hot idea, I think that, you know, talking to him about sending his son to die might be a bad idea.
Yeah.
But since that article was actually published by MSNBC, so since that article was published, I believe nobody's actually tried to contact him, and we actually haven't heard from him since.
Yeah. Well, Dylan, before we close the show out today, how are people going to be able to find this movie once it's out? Because I know we'll make it available on our site,
right.
But do you have a website address or something you'd like to give out?
Yeah, I do. There's two different addresses. Right now, Phil's hosting it on his other server, which is letsroll911.net,
uh-huh.
And I don't know exactly what his plans are for that site, but after that, if he turns it into something else, the other address, and this is going to stay permanent, is loosechange, all one word, .cjb.net.
Okay, and we'll put that
in.
That's
a redirect, and that'll send you straight there. And if everything goes according to plan, I'll have it done and ready to sell in like a week or two.
You know, I want to say some of the most compelling stuff in your documentary is the live audio of the firemen.
That's
calling like, in their reports about the fires and what was going on. I mean, it's just so gripping. And the reporters.
And I know that's true, because when Lisa was watching this, I looked over and
tears
saw.
Tears were welling in my eyes
just
listening to the emotion of it. Yeah. All over again.
So that's very powerful. So.
I unfortunately didn't get to throw in the segment about Flight 93, but I'm going to. It's just I didn't get the chance to finish it. But, you know, you guys already heard that caller to the Howard Stern show who was like, yeah, I mean, we saw an explosion. We saw smoke coming from the plane, and then two other planes flew over it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Dylan, one last question here. And I cover this very extensively in my book, 9/11 Exposed, and I think it's one of the biggest smoking guns. And you say in your movie that if you held a basketball at the top of the World Trade Center towers when they started to collapse and dropped it, the roof of the World Trade Center and a basketball would hit at the exact same time. Now, for that to happen, it completely defies the laws of physics.
Right. No resistance.
That would mean it'd have to do a complete zero resistance free fall. And that means nothing in between. So it just, how can anyone believe this cock and bull story?
You know, actually, I was at a 9/11 questions meetup a week or two ago. You guys know the website 9/11 Citizens Watch?
Yes.
Yeah.
You know the webmaster John Judge?
Oh yeah.
We've heard of him. Yeah.
Yeah. He was there, and every time this whole thing was basically I was the only. There was like maybe four people. We're sitting at this Chinese restaurant, just talking back and forth, and I'm bringing up all these things, all these inconsistencies, and he had an excuse for every single one of them. Like he completely believes the official story.
Yeah, John Judge.
I was talking to one family member who was there who lost his brother in the World Trade Center. I brought up the free fall that you just mentioned, and you want to know what his reaction to it was?
What?
Oh, it was cheap mafia steel in the World Trade Center.
Oh, God. That's incredible. And, you know, one of the most disappointing people in this whole movement is John Judge, and it seems like he's done everything to counter any release of valid information out there. So, yeah,
you guys are going to like this, too. I'm sorry to keep interrupting
you. Oh, go ahead.
He said he had a friend that worked at the Pentagon that when the plane was heading towards the Pentagon, he could see people in the cockpit.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah, it's interesting. All his friends.
Yeah, exactly.
I've got a friend who, you know, but, yeah.
With Dylan, we just want to thank you for sending the movie to us. As we said, as soon as it's released, we're going to have it available on our website, and you're doing a hell of a job with it. So,
we really appreciate it, Dylan, and all the time and the work you and the people at letsroll911.org have put into researching this subject, and we hope more people check out your DVD.
Right. It's very powerful.
Thanks a lot, guys. It's definitely been an honor to have been on the show.
Yeah. Well, thank you for being on.
Keep us up to date, Dylan.
Yeah.
Absolutely,
tomorrow.
Guys. Thanks again.
All right,
oh, you're
thank
welcome.
You.
Now, tomorrow, folks, November 2nd, the Secret Society election of 2004, go to the Wing TV homepage. One last time, anybody but Bush or Kerry, read what these guys are all about. We don't have to vote for them, and you don't have to vote for them.
Dissent.
All right. We'll see you tomorrow on Wing TV. 9 o'clock a.m. is when we're filming.
Take care.